Good morning, everyone. At this time of the year when there, it's not an ending, it's a blending.
Is the microphone on?
Yes.
I can yell pretty loud. So. In all seriousness, welcome. The policy of dislodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. For the purpose of carrying out these programs that we'll list now and give out, we meet twice a week. And then there's a special meeting on the third Friday of every month. Pick up one of these little pamphlets, and inside you will read program for January, February, and March. And as you will see, that for the month of January, the topic will be the path of spiritual evolution. January the 2nd, the power of a vow. Now, these study classes begin 7:45 and are over at 9. If you come in at 5:30, you go into the library and stay from 5:30 to 6:30. It's a reference library where you may obtain references and other literature to read for those that particular period. And there's always a volunteer there to help you go over these books and even give you an idea what the topic will be for that particular evening. In the middle room, there's a book table where you may purchase books at very reasonable prices. And you can examine them during library hours before, though, and after the meeting. Straight line theosophy, and what students always consider it a goldmine. Now, that third Friday of the month meeting, January 21st, in this particular case, is Buddha's Dhammapada. That's a book that you can even purchase in the hallway, or if you wish, read in the library. Wednesday nights is a study class, The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. And as you can see, you find his name mentioned to spread broadcast the teachings of theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. And all of its activities depend upon contributions voluntarily made. There's no obligation to participate. But if you would like to hear or get more information, speak to the volunteer at the book table on the way in and on the way out. Oh, yes, that January 21st meeting, 7 to 8, doors open always ahead of time that we just mentioned. And on the 21st, it's Buddha's Dhammapada. And we repeat that because that's a, for those of us who have are familiar with it, it's a very, very wonderful treatise, is the word to use. Mm-hmm. We have a reading for you this morning. It's titled The Symbolic Christ and is taken from Theosophy Magazine. You can inquire about Theosophy Magazine at the book table. It. The writers of the Gospels, whoever they may have been, disagree as to the place where Jesus was born. Matthew calls the place a house. Luke speaks of the infant as having been laid in a manger, which implies that he was born in a stable. But Eusebius, the great ecclesiastical historian of the 4th century, states that Jesus was born neither in a house nor a stable, but in a cave. And that the Emperor Constantine erected a temple on the spot so that Christians could worship in the very place where their Savior was born. The cave selected was one in which had once been celebrated the rites of Adonis. My subject this morning, question. Is there a Christmas cycle? Right.
Is there a Christmas cycle? Well, perhaps you may know, perhaps you may not, that it was a movable feast. The birth of Jesus the Christ may have been celebrated on January 5th or April 19th or May 20th. It was a variable festival. Biblical scholars today now suggest that Jesus must have been born in the autumn because that was the time of the Roman tax collecting. Others say, no, he must have been born in the spring because that was the time of the lambing, shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock. The reason scholars go back and forth and argue about it is there is absolutely no historical record at that time of such an infant being born. So how did this cycle come to be the time of the birth of Jesus the Christ, since no one knows when it was, and it was variable depending on when they decided to celebrate it. At the end of the 4th century, Cyril of Jerusalem, we think he was one of the bishops, asked the Pope to please make it a fixed festival, not a variable one. Quotes from that time tell us why. Saint Chrysostom in 390 AD wrote, "On this day also the birth of Christ was lately fixed at Rome, in order that whilst the heathen were busy with their profane ceremonies, the Christians might perform their holy rites undisturbed." And then in Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, "The Roman Christians, ignorant of the real date of Christ's birth, fixed the solemn festival on the 25th of December, the Rumalia, or winter solstice, when the pagans annually celebrated the birth of Sol. So there is a Christmas cycle, and the Christians joined in on it, honoring their Savior, but it is a more than just an individual cycle. It is the winter solstice, which began every year. It begins on December 21st, and it literally means Sol Stike, the sun sticks. It stops moving in the other direction and then gradually begins moving northward. If it didn't, we would be just a block of ice. So it is the winter solstice, but it isn't just a physical cycle. It is psychological. It is spiritual. It is the dawn of the new year. We say January 1st, but no, the year is born at the winter solstice, December 21st. It is a cyclic event. In ages, the wise have known about this astronomical cycle with the birth of the sun. So knowing what they know about the sun and its inner or real power, it is a cycle for humans, because just as the sun gets progressively warmer and closer to us and the days begin to get longer, so inside us, our spiritual nature begins to awaken and arise. A mundane way of saying it is just as the sap is rising in the trees, the sap is rising in us. There is this influx within our own nature that is physical, psychological, mental, but more importantly, it is a spiritual cycle. This is from the writings of HPB. This dawn of the new year, a period of awakening of spiritual vigor and energy, as well as physical vigor and energy, because the astral life of the earth is young and strong between Christmas and Easter. And we're sure in next week's presentation, you'll hear what a significance that has as far as making a vow. The astral life of the earth is young and strong. Now, you know, we're trying to think of some examples that would make us realize the potency of that statement. We happen to be wearing a magnetic necklace. So what happens with magnets? They attract each other. They stay. Why? The internal principles within them make that happen. We are electric magnetic, and the astral life of the earth is electromagnetic. We will feel it, and some people translate it as that jovial Christmas feeling, loving everyone and wanting to give to everyone. But it isn't that. It isn't an external social thing. It is an internal awakening, and if we would just realize it, we would begin moving towards that wholeness, that unity of seeing all life as one and the same as our life, that we are truly one. It is said that the other magnificent part of this cycle is that great beings are closer to us now during this cycle from Christmas to Easter. Now, maybe that doesn't sound important, but their influence is always in the world. It may be difficult for us to feel it, use it, or respond to it, but in this time of the year, it's easy for all of us. No matter how many walls we have inside us, we can feel, respond, and use that realization. Those great beings are not separate from us. They are our elder brothers. And you turn to your elder brothers for counsel and help, strength and wisdom. And we can do that more easily at this time of year. The festivals that we read about, the Saturnalia, the Brumalia, all of these ancient festivals for this time of year were created for mystical reasons, to implant certain ideas in humanity's heart. The idea of gift giving, of sharing with others, the idea of goodwill towards all, to opening one's heart. Because they could see into the soul of things, they know the truth about us, which we fail to see. We are a greater being in potential. They know we are identical to them. We don't know that. And these cyclic events can help to awaken that within us. You can't use something or grow something unless you know it's there. You have to find it first, and then you can make use of it. So anyway, these celebrations were the birth of the sun gods, and you may want to read about some of them. Adonis from Phoenicia, Bacchus and Apollo from Greece, Osiris and Horus from Egypt, Mithra, Persia, Krishna and Buddha, India, Dionysus, Babylon, Bacab, the Yucatan, we don't really know how to say this, Quetzalcoatl, Mexico. Now, interestingly enough, if you'd like to do some research, you will discover every one of them was born of a virgin mother. Every one of them has the same biography, the same legend and experiences, both astronomical, what was taking place in the sky, the winter solstice, and mystically. They all share the same history, which is mystical and biographical. Now, you can begin to see why the church adopted all of the same myths and legends for their savior, because the people of the world already had this information about everyone else. You couldn't have someone worshiping this new and unique savior if they didn't have those same properties. There are things that have bothered historians and theologians for centuries. Like if you go into the Louvre, you see a Madonna and Child that is absolutely Mary and Jesus. The problem is it's Isis. It's much, much, much older than the birth of Christ. Also, when the Spanish arrived in South America, they were shocked to see Madonna and Child in religious settings and a cross. And their only answer for this horrible dilemma was to say that obviously the devil planted those things as to challenge the faithful in future centuries. So we're sure they didn't understand what was going on. And really, if people did understand, if people could say to themselves, well, you know, Christ, Krishna, Buddha, they're all one and the same brotherhood of wise humans who come to help humanity. It doesn't diminish Jesus that we make this realization. It is honest because it speaks to the problems in trying to accept the traditions that are given by the Christian church. And it is honest in that it unites all of these teachings. We had the Sermon on the Mount for our Friday class. You can take the Sermon on the Mount and the teachings of the Buddha and try to find a difference. You can't. The Sermon on the Mount is Buddhistic. A great example is Krishna, who was born in 3102 before the Common Era. So that's like 5,000 years ago. But his mother's name was Maya. She had an annunciation by an angel who came and told her about this birth that was going to take place. He was born in a stable, and he was visited as an infant by three wise men. Where did I have that? Because that's, yeah. In Luxor in Egypt, 1700 BC, there are four carved scenes. The first, angels on a cloud speaking to shepherds in the field. The second, one angel speaking to a maiden. The third, a nativity or a birth scene with an ox and an ass. And the fourth, three noblemen kneeling with gifts. So we see it, the birth of Krishna, 3102 BC, and in the temple of Luxor. It must be a celebration of the events of the life of Isis and the birth of her child. Why a manger? Why a stable? Why a cave? Why is that used? Well, the fact is we're talking about ourselves, not just a highly evolved spiritual being. We're a highly unevolved spiritual being, so it's really the same thing. We just haven't done the work yet. Born into a manger or a stable or a cave means that spiritual godlike being born on the earth. As a matter of fact, we say Jesus was born in Bethlehem. In Hebrew, Bethlehem means the house of bread. What is the house of bread? The human form. So, born in Bethlehem? Yes, we all were born in Bethlehem. What the ancients taught about the events of the winter solstice, first you have 1221, when the sun actually begins to stick, solstice. Then it is said that the wise ones, the sun gods, enter into the earth down below, into the solar, the seeds, and germinate them, get them warmed and beginning to bloom. So 3 days after their descent on the solstice is December 25th. And then they are born into humanity. Theosophy stresses to us that Christos is a principle, not a being. And that principle resides within all of life. The table, the atom, the sun, everywhere within us. But it is buried in a cave, in a stable, in a manger. In the lower kingdoms, it can't awaken because there's no self-consciousness there to realize that that principle is there. We can't awaken it because either we don't know it's there, or knowing it's there, we won't listen to it. When we're tempted to do something we know we shouldn't, we usually argue with ourselves so we can get to end up doing what we know we shouldn't. So the principle is there if we would turn to it, if we would listen to it. Perhaps the best book we have for that is The Voice of the Silence. It is a devotional book. We had more examples of things within the festival, but we thought we'd save them for your questions. But one of our favorites is how Santa Claus came to be. He was real. He was a bishop in Asia Minor. His name was Nicholas. He was from Patara in the 4th century. And he literally went from, it was a terrible time in Turkey, and he went to the homes where they were starving and very poor, very struggling, and he would leave gifts of gold or food. How did he come to be called Santa Claus? The Dutch children coming here to the United States brought the tale with them, and they said, San Nicholas. They're talking about Saint Nicholas. San Nicholas became Santa Claus. And of course, we did all the other commercial things with him, making him fat and red and white, and that's just our artistry. But he was real, and he represents the real spirit of Christmas, because he gave anonymously. Anyway, your questions are invited. Yes?
Well, one point then, a question. We think the bishops at the time wore dark red velvet robes. Mm-hmm. So part of the costume actually was authentic. We remember reading that. Our question would be about evergreen.
Yes.
The tree is adorned. Is there some symbology in the tree?
There's tremendous symbology, but that, you know, again, that goes way back to ancient times. Evergreen says it right there, this constant renewal of life. Because when we look out in the winter, we see dead things, barren things, and Theosophy reminds us, if it weren't for this time, the seeds under the ground could not germinate and be ready to bloom in the spring. The spring is a result. The cause is the winter. It's very confusing to our minds, but the evergreen was sacred, as we all know, to the Druids, and they would bring the evergreen into the home. They did this, of course, in Scandinavia, all of the northern European countries, and because the whole thing is a festival of light, so they would ornament the greenery. And it is said that a Christmas tree really represents a human being upside down. We are trees with our branches, and our head is the root ball of the tree, and it's into the air, whereas the other tree is just the opposite. Its roots are into the ground. And decorated and lit, the tree represents us with our higher powers awake and alive and in use. Yes?
This is more of a comment, but it seems in the earlier stages of Christianity, Jesus was considered one of the sun gods, at least among the Gnostics.
Mm-hmm.
And we remember seeing a tile, a mosaic, of the earliest representation known of Jesus, and it's in their picture with the sun corona sort of coming out of his head, representing the same idea represented in Egypt.
Right. Yes, exactly. But it's today's world we have to work with, and most Christians would be very confused by most of these ideas and upset, and yet it does not denigrate the respect and admiration and appreciation. I mean, the very idea of a highly evolved spiritual being stepping into this cesspool we call Earth, I mean, can you imagine? Would we find it easy to do? Would you go to the world's worst place and try to raise up the monsters that were misbehaving there? I don't think so. It would be very difficult. They have to sacrifice so much to come to us. Yes. Well, there was no, it's not a compilation. There was a definite teacher on the scene, and it was supposed to be about 100 years before they claimed that Jesus was there. And if you look at history, wouldn't you think that the things that Herod supposedly did, especially the murder of all the innocents, trying to kill all the infants, there's no historical record of any of that. His name was Joshua ben
Pandira.
We never get the last right. And he lived 100 years before. He walked among men. He taught. He performed things that were considered miraculous, but are not. Theosophy says that with our true use of our true powers, it's not a miracle against law, it is understanding law from its heart and its source. It's an, what's that word when you, intensify. It's an intensification of the law, not contradiction to it. So he, and then later Apollonius of Tyana, was after Pandira, and he made such a stir by the things he was capable of doing that the early Christians questioned, why is this man who isn't a Christian able to do these things, and you, who was a disciple of Christ, can't do them? So that's historical. But in a way, it doesn't matter. It is the idea of a teacher coming to help humanity, and then what we do with those teachings. Yes.
Well, how do we end up with the Jesus Christ of the New Testament? Where did that come from?
Well, if you read Isis Unveiled and read the Secret Doctrine, I know that's asking you to do a lot, but make it a New Year's resolution. You'll find it absolutely fascinating. According to HPB, at some point there was an argument. This was several hundred years after Jesus was supposed to have been crucified. There was an argument within the church about which gospels they were going to keep and were going to say, this is the word of God. And we just find this very sad. Supposedly, all the Gospels were put on a table in a room, and the doors were locked, and whatever Gospels were left on the table the next morning were the ones that were used. I don't trust that idea. I don't know about you. But the strange thing is, and many, many scholars have looked at this, the fact is that the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, do not agree with each other. They all depict one and the same thing in many ways, but they do not agree with each other. So the church is based on ideas that were borrowed, reworked, and then given to the public. But that isn't so much the problem, because we're sure that Mithra, I'm sure that the legends around him were reworked and things. The real problem is saying that this was the one and only, that this was the unique Savior, and anyone and anything else should not be believed or accepted. And that battle is going on right this minute in this country. It's absolutely amazing. Way in the back, you've had your hand.
Speaking of borrowed ideas, if we look at that story of the truth of the 3 days between the winter solstice fixed date and this
3 days later.
It coming, being resurrected.
Mm-hmm.
So is there symbology there? Is this a reminder? Is there a correspondence?
Well, of course there's symbology, but we have to remember no symbol was ever picked by those wise beings that wasn't real. We just can't see it at that level. It is physical, historical, geographical, psychological, spiritual. In other words, there is something to be said for the 3 days. But we couldn't tell you for certain what it was, but it's repeated over and over. 3, 7, and 10 are very important spiritual cycles. Yes?
If it's a mystical fact,
mm-hmm,
that the Christos, the Christos principle is born in us, reborn in us at this time of year.
Or reawakened.
Reawakened.
Yeah.
How do we know that? How do we recognize that? What do we do with it at this time of year?
Well, do you mean if we don't know anything about it, or if we're really active?
If we accept that idea.
Okay.
How would we
recognize that there is this spiritual awakening within ourselves? We will ask you. How would we recognize? Yes.
Well, one of the ideas pointed out earlier was we feel this sense of brotherliness, this willingness to give, this warmth at this time. We can look at those as representations of,
mm-hmm,
the highest of that principle. When we let it go and forget about it and consider the season over is where the problems begin.
Okay. But it's even more than the brotherliness. We tolerate sometimes relatives that we wouldn't speak to the rest of the year, but we have this loving feeling for them, at least for the moment. Now, we're supposed to have that all the time. We're supposed to realize and understand that. There's also the true desire to give. It's terrible what we've done with it. I hate these things they show on television where they show 3 or 4 children opening their presents, and the children are screaming and joyous, and then they reach for the next thing, and then they complain because they don't like it or something. When it should be giving of yourself, making cookies for people, or going to visit someone who doesn't have anyone to visit them. It's something we should be giving to our children to teach them you'll get more joy out of giving from yourself than any present you will ever receive in your life. So these ideas, we are told, were implanted in humanity at its infancy. In other words, when we, as spiritual beings, as thinkers, incarnated initially into the human form, we didn't even require language. We could read each other's minds. We knew that we were identical with those higher beings who were teaching us. Just as a child knows it belongs to those parents and feels at one with it, even though the relationship has a huge difference. So in that initial education, we learned about the arts, about agriculture, about all of the things that we were going to need, and we knew that we were united, that we were one, and that is renewed every winter solstice. Yes.
For years we've wondered if that's the case, why is it also very prevalent at this time that there's so much despondency and despair?
Mm-hmm.
And then it gradually occurred to us that in all the scriptures about devotion, whether we look at the initial chapter of the Bhagavad Gita or what HPB says about awakening, initiation, one of the first things that occurs when we become aware of that higher
Mr. Judge makes a wonderful analogy of that. He says, you can look out and see, oh, isn't it beautiful? It's the moonlight on the snow, and it's glorious, and you're enjoying the view. That's you looking at your own nature. And then the sun comes out in the morning, and you realize what you're looking at is the snow on a garbage dump. And you couldn't see that until the sun was there. But the very fact that you can see it means that now you have the power to clean it up, to fix it, to change it. Until you see it, you can't do anything about it. It's just this beautiful thing to you. You had your hand up.
Well, we were wondering, it probably has more to do with Easter now that we think about it. But
rushing the seasons.
The fact that the risen Christ came back to work with the disciples, could that be a hint that masters can work both in a body and behind the scenes out of a body?
Actually, it is said most of the work of that brotherhood of masters is out of a physical body, but an inner purified astral body. Their work is to influence humanity. And to work directly with us is pointless in many ways. It is said that we, who study these ideas, are considered the companions of the masters because we can do what they would do if they could be here, and that's remind of law, of unity, of brotherhood, of the true nature of every one of us. Yes?
I want to get back to the sense of despondency.
Yes.
At this time, and that reminds me of St. John's Dark Night of the Soul,
mm-hmm.
which we believe everyone at some point goes through.
Maybe once or twice a week.
Well, but the real depth of that sense,
yes.
of the dark night, the abyss, that sense of being totally alone and lost.
But we are told not to dwell on that.
Exactly.
Right.
Because once you have experienced it, you know if it comes back, you will always come again.
Yes, you are
just
always
like the sun
ready.
Rises, the days go long.
Right. Well, you know, HPB says our biggest problem is not contrast, because contrast is how we learn. Our biggest problem is we do extremes. We're not just despondent, we're absolutely beyond the pale. That we never, no matter what, we never lose our spiritual nature. We may lose our opportunity on this planet because we don't care about others, and we reject, and we are abusive to our own nature as well as others' nature, then we would have to drop out and await the next period of evolution. But when you really stop and realize it, we cannot be destroyed. We can only be despondent or constrained by our own choices and behavior. Yes.
Well, now that the snow is actively coming
is
down,
is it really?
We're reminded of the last comment about the extremes. We're told that if we're driving in a snowstorm and we have to stop, that we don't slam on our brakes,
right.
and we don't go the opposite way. We have to pump
go
the brake,
with it.
Apply steady pressure, but steady pressure, not violent pressure, and to go with it. So we need to, instead of reacting against it, we need to go with it to come out of it.
You're talking to a Midwestern girl, so. One of the things that creates even more despondency is we have this idea, all right, I not only see these wonderful spiritual teachings, I understand them. I accept them. This is wonderful. And then we think we can turn around and go the other way. But it's the same thing as with a car. If you were driving 60 miles an hour down the highway and you went, you know what, I'm going the wrong way, could you just turn around and go that way? No. You have to slow, yeah, I know. You have to slow down and come to at least part of a stop before you can safely turn around. But back to the question about seeing that that true spiritual identity within ourselves. We don't know if any of you have ever read Epictetus, but we recommend it. Go to the library and take out the Discourses of Epictetus, E-P-I-C-T-E-T-U-S. You will laugh out loud. He speaks to, he's a Stoic philosopher, and in speaking to his students, he's very down to earth. One of them complains, someone stole my statue out on the gate of my property. And Epictetus said, yes, because you had one. It's as simple as that. You had one. If you didn't have a statue, nobody could have stolen it. Now be serious, you know? Anyway, when someone was saying, why do we have so much trouble? Why don't we, if we are these wonderful spiritual beings, why don't we have an easy time of it? Why don't we have the power to just make this happen and that happen and not have all this difficulty? And his answer is absolutely marvelous. He says, you know, if Zeus, that's what he's calling this divine absolute power, if Zeus could have, he would have given you all of that. But he couldn't. So he was limited in just being able to give you the divine powers that you have. And if you stop and think about it, they're the same powers that Zeus has. The power to look behind, the power to look ahead, the power to decide, to choose between this or that, and then the power to act on your choice, and the most important one, the power to throw it all out and do something else. Those are the powers of a God, and those are the powers that we have. And we think the simplest way to prove that to yourself, because what we usually do is follow whatever impulse the desires and the body are telling us to follow. The simplest way to prove that to yourself is just once say no. Someone used to use an example here, chocolate cake. You are passionate about chocolate cake, and somebody gives you this beautiful chocolate cake, and you're ready to dive into it. Prove. Say no. No, I am not going to have that. You'll suffer a little, but you will win. You will prove, wait, I make these decisions. Yes?
The man who baptized my son when he brought the baptismal certificate to the house, I happened to have a chocolate cake, and I offered him some, and he said, I've been dieting, so I'm really going to enjoy not eating that chocolate cake. So right then I thought to myself, well, you know what? When I stopped smoking cigarettes, that's how I want to do it. And I did it. It took me over 37 years.
Bravo.
And they're like in a nursing home now, but I emailed the wife who I used to work with, and I let her know, and she's going to pass along to her husband, that his actions did not go unnoticed.
Well, that's wonderful, but you know, our actions never go unnoticed. That's another thing we have to realize about ourselves. I don't know if Epictetus mentioned this power of Zeus. Yeah, you can look backwards, you can look forward. You retain everything. Everything you ever saw, read, thought, smelled, tasted, it's all there. At the end of this life, you will watch that like a DVD. You will see your entire life start to finish. Every dream you ever had is all there. And then you can digest or assimilate the best of that life. Yes?
Just comment on a few of the things.
Right, the animal nature.
So it reminds us that this, we feel the presence of this principle most directly in our animal human nature. And maybe that's where we need to begin, not to repress it, destroy it, deprive it, but to gradually tame it and educate it to a higher
and
goal.
Definitely not be despondent over it. You know, it's funny how we will look at some things and refuse to see that they are real and natural. We act like because we've learned about the spiritual nature, well, now we can just do it, that there's nothing that needs to be done. We just go around and talk about it. But the fact is, that would be like taking a two-year-old and saying, oh, well, you know, that's going to be a grown-up. Act like a grown-up now. Well, the two-year-old can't. It's got steps and stages to go through. We are the same. Well, I'm not going to insult us and say we're two, but we're teenagers. And we know how difficult the teenage years are. So we, in order to accomplish this, instead of being despondent, we have to say to ourselves, you know, growth is growth. And every inch means you're that much closer to gaining control over your own nature. Why be despondent? That would be like a gardener who planted all the wrong things and has this wonderful crop saying, you know, I'm a failure. No, you've got good ground. You've got good planting skills. Plant differently. Change the causes. Yes.
But in a sense, we are brilliant, and you'll see the pun in a moment, because in this time of despondency, in this natural cycle of the least amount of light, what do? We surround ourselves with light.
Mm-hmm.
We color and light up our homes. We light the tree, as was said. We light candles in different ceremonies. We fill ourselves with this visual of brilliance to remind ourselves that is within, and we just need to call upon it to bring it out and become aware of it. So we give ourselves reminders this time.
Well, that again comes from our elder brothers. This is the Festival of Lights. Everywhere around the world, through all ages and times, it has always been the Festival of Lights. And I think people think it's because it's dark. No, it's because the light is so bright inside you, you bring it out into the world. You share it with the world. Yes?
To your knowledge, is there any metaphysical information available that would explain the principle of the virgin births?
Ah, yes.
Often wondered about
several,
that. Sure,
there's several things. The virgin birth, first, what's in the sky at the time of the birth of the sun gods? Virgo. What does Virgo represent? The virgin. So that's the astronomical explanation. It is Virgo in the sky. And we come back again to the Bethlehem, house of bread. What is in Virgo's hand? Does anybody know? Wheat. Wheat. So, wait, there's another one, though, too. I know. Well, I probably don't have it written down, but the other main point is it's the quality of the birth that's going to happen. It's going to happen through natural means. In other words, a male and a female, a sperm and an egg, but they are pure enough to give birth to this pure child. So it is the
so it is through a natural biological processes, but in a very high state.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And in order to recognize it as a high state, it is spoken of as virgin or pure. Yes.
But and that's a little bit different from the idea of immaculate conception.
Right.
Which refers to the fact that the real nature of this being, the spiritual being,
is immaculate,
not of the earth.
Right.
Is
immaculate. Yes.
Divine.
Yes.
Could it be throughout the ages, the people who wrote the Bible weren't of
Right.
When we're
but
going
again, that virgin birth goes back to ancient cultures. So it was a borrowed idea, and at its foundation or basis, there's nothing wrong with the idea. It's the fact that you take the physical out of it when it's astronomical, physical, symbolical. Yes.
In fact, we've seen that more change that evolved in the modern day Christian when they speak of born again. It is born again, not physically born again, but
right.
Born again in spirit.
Actually, we are told that we have to be born again because, well, we were born the first time as infant humanity. Our own nature was words. We were aware that we were spiritual, and we were wearing this new costume, the human form on this planet. And we were also aware that we chose to come and do this work, to share with each other and to elevate the lower kingdom. So we knew I am spiritual and all of life is spiritual. We got that early education from our elder brothers, and then the way you do with any child, you leave that child on its own to make use of its powers to grow from the experience. Yes.
Interesting thing about that, possibly one of the most detrimental things is that this idea of Jesus Christ being the only one capable of that, when in reality it's all it belongs to humanity, that their ability to evolve.
And who said that best?
Jesus.
Yes.
Yes. He's the one who said that. Of course, the Buddha said it more simply, look within, thou art Buddha. Now, we only have a few minutes left, and we wanted to read this. We think it is so marvelous, and since it isn't credited to HPB or Judge, it's by a ULT student. And you'll find it in the inside of your January, February, March periodical. It's titled, The Spirit That Wills. The work of the world calls ever more tragically for strong, sure hands, steady hearts, and clear minds. Hunger, privation, and anguish are the brutal order of the day for many millions. And in the fields of human endeavor, the harvest of bitterness alone seems ready for reaping. But man is still a creator, and for him, the seed time never passes. Each day brings fresh ground to his hand, and the seed is his for selecting. He need not stand blindly in yesterday's harvest, nor spend fear for tomorrow's reaping. These are and will be effects, and today is for sowing new causes, nurturing a better harvest. There is no single task for all men, but each has his own. The need is for unity of motivation, not identity of action. Sympathy, not sameness in efforts. The work is not this or that, here or there. It is the will to help. The resolve that changes every act, no, that charges every act with healing currents of courage, strength, and fraternity. The work is thought and thinking, a gift that enriches the giver, lightens his own burdens, and gains him the greater freedom of a more selfless life. Let none say the work is not his, lest the omitted deeds of a callous heart invite yet deeper tragedy for him to share. May each find the task for his skill, bearer of his active brotherhood. Let none say the work is too great, allowing modesty to mask unwillingness. For man is a spirit that wills, and power flows not from misgivings. Let no man put off a beginning, for greatness of purpose sustaining the smallest effort is an irresistible force. Let never events dismay, for they have died when they happen. And the man of action will not revive them by cowardice, nor permit them to feed on his weakness. His faith is a consuming fire, his aspiration a purifying flame, and devotion itself works on the plane where action is born. Let none say his time is full, for this of all work is most pressing. Meeting is adjourned.